Jane Houston was one of the pioneers of the human potential movement way, way back a long time. She's still around doing stuff now. But when she was in her younger years, she was living on the Upper East Side of New York City. And one morning, she was running down the sidewalk, late for her school bus as usual, when she whipped around a corner and ran smack into this old man, knocking them both off their feet. I'm sorry, sir. Can I help you? I'm sorry. Old man looked up at her from the sidewalk and said, young lady, are you going to be in such a rush all your life? Well, sir, I don't know, sir. I guess so, sir. Mm-hmm. And he smiled, his eyes started to sparkle, and he said, well then, bon voyage. And the following day, is this sort of first abrupt encounter turned into a longer conversations. And she couldn't quite get his name because they had this very, very heavy French accent. It was Tier or Tear or something like that. And she took to calling him Mr. Thayer. And pretty soon, Jane Houston and Mr. Thayer were taking walks in Central Park together. And he had this bright, playful spirit. Jean, come see, look at this caterpillar here. Look at how he walks up that leaf. How does he know to move all those legs together? Jean, come look, see this spider over here. How does she know how to weave that beautiful? He seemed to be just completely enchanted by the natural world. And then she didn't see him for a few days. Didn't see him for a few days more. And she didn't know how to check on him. She didn't actually know where he lived. And then one day in the New York Times, back in one of the back pages down the bottom, she saw his photograph. There's a portrait of him. Mom, here's Mr. Thayer. And the caption on it said that on Sunday evening, Easter Sunday evening, Thierry de Chardin had a heart attack and died. Thierry de Chardin was a Jesuit priest who had been censored by the church for some ideas expressed in this manuscript called The Phenomena of Man. And the church didn't know quite what to do with him, so they had sent him to live out his later years at the Church of St. Ignatius Loyola on Park Avenue in New York City. So Jane Houston had been rambling in the park with one of the 20th century's greatest theologians and mystics. And I just love the image of this old man with these sparkly eyes looking up at this young girl and saying, bon voyage! And I like the image of strolling in the park with this elderly priest who is just delighted, you know, in the caterpillars and the spiders and the trees, and who sense of self didn't seem to cling to one body or set of ideas or personality. Or he was just out there, merged with the natural world. So what would that feel like? To have an awareness that is so relaxed that it just loses its boundaries and blends with the world around. What would that be like? To have an awareness that is crisp and clear as the air on a spring morning, and yet is not weighed down or burdened by thoughts about my ideas, my personality, my needs. What would that feel like to be Thierry de Chardin, just out there, merged with the wonders of life itself? Just out there. Well, Thierry de Chardin was Catholic, at least in name. We're Buddhists, at least in name. But I think the path that the Buddha laid out, what it's pointing towards, is pointing right towards whatever that is that Thierry de Chardin embodied. So tonight I would like to talk about what I would call the infinitely expanding self, as illustrated, as embodied by Thierry de Chardin. The Buddha, you know, there's this whole idea of anatta, non-self. But the Buddha never actually said we don't have a self. What he said is that there is no self-essence that separates us from one another or from the rest of life. So we could call this non-self or selflessness. We could also call it an infinitely expanding self that expands to include everything. The sense of self includes everything, that it doesn't separate anymore. So it amounts to the same thing. Non-self, infinite expanding self seem to move in opposite directions, but they end up back in the same place. T.S. Eliot once wrote, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." So the path to non-self or selflessness, I think, was probably more accessible to people in the Buddha's time. And for reasons that we'll explore tonight, I think the path to infinite self, this expanded self, is probably more available to us today. But it really ends up in the same place. Ends up in the same place. For those of you who know me, you know my voice tends to, as I really get into something, my voice tends to disappear. So if I start to fade, just point to your ear or something like that, because I'm incorrigible. It'll just disappear. But if I see you're having trouble hearing, my voice will go up. I don't even have to do it. So just let me know. The sense of self is deeply wired into us. And I think it's wired in simply by natural selection. I think it's really that simple. If you just imagine two ancient ancestors a million years ago, one has this really strong sense of self, something that needs to be protected, you know, kind of a little bit uptight. Another is very relaxed and mellow and actually doesn't care whether he lives or dies. You know, whose DNA do you think we inherited? So I think this whole sense of self that's so strong with us is really just an evolutionary fluke. It doesn't reflect a larger reality. It's just that it was a product of the laws of natural selection. The Buddha called it bhavatana, the desire to exist. Bhavatana is an anusya. Anybody familiar with that term, anusya? Sometimes it's translated as a latent tendency. An anusya is like a hindrance, but it's a deeply, deeply wired in hindrance that's actually very difficult to see. But anusyas, they completely color and shape our experience, even though they're very difficult to see. And so you can see it. With bhavatana, with a desire to exist. The only time we're aware of it is when we feel threatened, you know, fight or flight. And then all our awareness goes out there to the threat rather than to the inner experience that we're having. Does that make sense? Too bad if it doesn't. I don't know. So what I'd like to do tonight, and it'll take a little bit of work, so bear with me and interrupt me if you need some clarity. But what I'd like to do is look at the sense of self in a little bit of evolutionary detail. So over a million years ago, the human brain became large and complex and actually quite malleable. You know, our capacity to learn from our fellow creatures and from the environment skyrocketed. And since then, human evolution has had very little to do with DNA and genes, and has had everything to do with how we program and train and educate these very flexible minds of our children. So human evolution today has very little to do with body structures, you know, teeth or bones or claws or things like that, and has everything to do with consciousness. Consciousness is a very tricky word in English. It has two completely different meanings. One meaning of consciousness is awareness. When somebody loses consciousness, they lose their awareness. And when you look in the Buddhist text, when the word consciousness appears there, it usually refers to awareness. So eye consciousness is different than ear consciousness. It's just a kind of stuffy way of saying that seeing awareness is different than hearing awareness, which it obviously is. The other meaning of the word consciousness is how we process information and assign meaning to it. I'm borrowing this from Daniel Siegel. So, for example, a 4-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 40-year-old. Grandfather, father, and son are walking down the street together. They see the same sights, they hear the same sounds, they have the same sensations come to their feet when they walk, and yet they are living in completely different worlds. Because how they process and interpret those sounds and sights and how they think about it is very, very different. They have different consciousness. A Tea Party enthusiast and a liberal progressive look out across the political scene. Maybe they see all the same data, but how they interpret it is completely different. They come to very different conclusions because they have a different consciousness. They process information differently. So when we talk about evolution of consciousness, we're talking about evolution and how we process information and assign meaning to it. So there are people like Claire Graves, Spiral Dynamics, Ken Wilber, Spectrum of Consciousness, lots and lots of people who have been mapping out. James, do you remember James back in the 60s, the breakdown of the origins of consciousness and the breakdown of the bicameral mind? He was looking at it. It's actually a great book. The most difficult part of the whole book is the title. So lots of people have been mapping out how human consciousness has evolved over the last thousands of years. So hundreds of thousands of years ago, when our ancient ancestors were those living those furtive lives in the primeval forest, some of them, some fluke of genes, had this instinct which bound them together a little bit more. They began to look out for each other a little bit more. Maybe it was as simple as when there was a threat, rather than silently running away, they would scream, "Bah!" And then run. Signal each other. But somehow this came into the human gene pool. They started looking out for one another. And this gave rise to what today we might call tribal consciousness. Okay. Tribal consciousness has no sense of individuality as we understand it today. The sense of self is fused with the tribe, with the custom, with the customs, with traditions passed down from the ancestors. They basically operate as a unit. So this instinctual cooperation made them more adaptable. They would live longer, survive longer, reproduce more, and so it worked. But the difficulty with tribal consciousness is that it's not very flexible. So in times of rapid change or threats, it wasn't terribly adaptable. So thousands, just a few thousand years ago, maybe a little bit more than that, another consciousness emerged, which is called magic heroic consciousness. And with it, there is just the beginnings of a sense of self. So what happened is there were some rare individuals who have thoughts or feelings or urges or impulses that didn't fit into the tribal mentality. And rather than filter them out or screen them out, but listen to them, and they acted on them. And so they moved a little bit out of the tribal tradition, and it felt very magical and powerful. By the way, all children grow through these stages. So all children go through a magical, heroic stage. So, for example, if you have a child like this, and maybe they have a set of blocks that they're playing with. The blocks are painted yellow on one side and blue on the other. So they're playing with these blocks, and so I pick up one of the blocks, and I show it to them. And it has the yellow side towards him and the blue side towards me. And I say, what does this look like to me? And before a certain age, the child will say, what do they say, yellow? He sees yellow. He will say, he thinks I see yellow. Before a certain age, a child does not have the intellectual maturity. It seems so simple, but you think about it. To create an image of this block in his mind and turn it around and look at it from the other side. So they're perceptually seduced. What he sees is what I see. So this magic heroic consciousness had a similar quality to it. It wasn't that a heroic leader disregards the thoughts and opinions of others. It just can't imagine anybody having a different perspective than his own. You know people like that.
I know.
These haven't disappeared from the earth, believe me. And then what happened for the rest of the tribe, their loyalty to the tradition got refocused onto this one flamboyant leader. So, for example, let's give an historical example. Menelaus, remember Menelaus, the king of Sparta? He had a wife named Helen, a beautiful woman, by the tradition, who ran off with this guy named Paris, who was a wayward prince of Troy. Ran off with him. Well, Menelaus was upset. He was angry. He wanted to get his wife back. So he takes off to Troy to get his wife back. And all the armies of Sparta go on with him, because he's our leader. And it doesn't seem that like Menelaus or any of the soldiers stop to think, you know, is it really in all of our best interest to go to war to get this guy's wife back? Ours is not to question why. Ours is but to do or die. Hoorah! And off they go to war. I was in the gym a few weeks ago, and I got talking to this guy. He was an ex-Special Forces. And we were talking, and in the middle of conversation, he stopped and he paused and he looked at me and he said, "You're a thinker." And I got it. He self-identified as a doer. I mean, he's an intelligent, charming, very smart guy, but he was very comfortable having the chain of command do the thinking for him. So that's magic heroic kind of thinking. Other examples of it include the Egyptian pharaohs. You know, their whims were law. Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, feudal systems, Jesus as savior. They don't offend anyone. Believe in Jesus and I'll take care of you. That's magic heroic kind of thinking. In modern times, we have street gangs oftentimes operate magic heroic. The villains in James Bond movies, they're usually magic heroic. Wild rock stars, frontier mentality. In children, you see it in parallel play. Sometimes you see it in adults, parallel play. terrible twos. So heroic cultures were much more effective in battle. because they could adapt more rapidly to changing conditions than the leader could. And they were much more adaptable to other types of changing conditions than the tradition-bound tribal consciousness that preceded them. So they were much more successful. But they had their drawbacks and limitations. So just think about the Spartan soldiers rowing their boats from Troy back to Sparta. All the spoils of war goes to Menelaus and a chosen few around him. Very few goes down to the actual soldiers. So as the tribes grew larger and became more and more people risked their lives, they needed a much more equitable distribution of resources. So a new consciousness emerged that expanded the circle of caring from me to us. Today we call this traditional, mythical, or literal thinking. People began to care about other people and their family or tribe or clan. We take care of our own. That's traditional thinking. So to accomplish this, what happened was that the power to make decisions was taken from a few self-centric bosses, or a self-centric boss, and pushed up to some ancient god who cared about all his people. So think about the 12 tribes of Israel. Rather than have different tribes, each tribe had a different god, and this god spoke to the leader of each tribe. Rather than all those separate gods, Yahweh emerges as a trans-tribal god. You know, one set of rules that apply to all these different tribes. So now when the tribes run into each other out in the wilderness, rather than just whacking each other, they've got some common ground, Yahweh, through whom they can cooperate. So this consciousness, this what we call traditional consciousness today, allowed for larger tribes and actually allowed for cities and nations to begin to emerge. You know, you can't have a very large city if it's all magical or conscious. You just have a bunch of gangs running around beating each other up. So this allowed for a set of rules that applied to everybody, which allowed these larger groups to grow. So examples of, let me back up just a second. One thing to understand about the traditional consciousness is that the rules and the laws that come down from these ancient authorities tend to be very rigid, very authoritarian, and rather inflexible. And they are group-centric rather than self-centric. So today, examples of it include ethnocentrism, love it or leave it patriotism, fundamentalism of all stripes, Jesus as lawgiver, Lake Wobegon, right, that's a traditional consciousness, is not Garrison Keillor, but as he portrays the town. Quote-unquote traditional values. And probably the most bloody example that's emerged recently is ISIS. A very tradition-bound consciousness. There's us and our folks, and then the other people aren't quite human. They relate outside of us. So we have to move forward a couple of millennia to get the next stage of consciousness emerged. In the middle of the 17th century, a new modern rational consciousness emerged in the West that included me, us, and for the first time, them. So in this consciousness, God's laws could be discerned not just by looking at ancient text, but also just by looking at the world. So Galileo, when he was trying to figure out how the universe worked, rather than just look through all the ancient scriptures, look through his telescope, you know, see for himself. So his modern rational consciousness gave rise to the scientific method. It gave rise to carefully measured experience, to look at our experience a little more objectively. And this consciousness was much more interested in bottom line results. And if that meant throwing the old authorities aside, it was perfectly willing to do that. So if you can see where we're going here, magic heroic consciousness is self-centric, first person, me. Traditional is a second person, group-centric, me, you, and heck with the rest of them consciousness. And then modern rational is actually world-centric, third person, me, you, and them consciousness. And it was wildly successful. There has been slavery as a part of human society back for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Modern consciousness emerged, and within about 100 or 150 years, slavery was outlawed in all modern societies. Science extended human life expectancy by decades or more. So examples of modern consciousness include the Western Enlightenment, emerging middle class, Jesus as tradition breaker, you know, the guy who threw the money changers out of the temple. Scientific revolution, the Industrial Revolution, Wall Street, the Monroe Doctrine, make the world safe for democracy. Advertising industry, chambers of commerce, or modern rational, transnational corporations. So the advances of modern science and the Western Enlightenment are really very difficult to overstate. However, by the middle of the 20th century, some of the limitations became apparent. For example, transnational corporations use reason, right, and high technology. They actually want to understand other people so they can exploit them better. Right? So many of them overlooked the well-being of others. They wanted to understand others, but overlooked their well-being or the environment if it suited their spreadsheets. So in the middle of the 20th century, there was a new stage of consciousness that began to emerge into general society. First, the philosophers didn't know what to call it, so they just called it postmodern. So it came after the modern. But today we tend to call it postmodern pluralism. And postmodern pluralism truly values other people, values helping the oppressed, values feelings, inclusiveness, consensus, ecology, collaboration. Does this sound familiar to anybody? Its slogan is kind of everything is beautiful in its own way. It tends to be very relativistic. So postmodern pluralism gave rise to the civil rights movement, gave rise to feminism, gay rights, marriage equality, other liberations movements. Other examples of it include Jesus as humanitarian, you know, the Good Samaritan story. All these different, you know, images of Jesus. I love to throw this in. It also, postmodern pluralism also includes things like Greenpeace, ACLU, Doctors Without Borders, animal rights activists, extend the circle of caring out to include other creatures, sensitivity training. I remember that movement. Occupy Wall Street is a postmodern pluralism type of thinking. Okay, I know I'm putting a lot of stuff on you here. So let's just step back for a moment. We've gone through five stages. Collectively, these are called first-tier consciousness. So we go from tribal to heroic to traditional to modern rational to post-modern pluralism. Each stage here includes more and more people. They include more and more people. So inclusiveness and expanding the circle of caring turn out to be very good measures of maturity of consciousness. But there's one limitation in all these first year, all these five stages, which is that all of them tend to think that their way of thinking is the most legitimate. And people who are at earlier stages are just Neanderthal. You know, think of how a modern rational or a postmodern pluralist looks at a fundamentalist. You know, are they stupid? And each of these stages tends to see the higher stages above them as like really kind of spaced out in a psychedelic haze. They've just kind of lost touch with reality. Even the most advanced of these stages, postmodern pluralism, has actually had difficulty empathizing with people who think differently than they do. They may value them, but they really don't understand how they think. Now, if we look around the world today at modern industrial societies, most of them have their center of gravity in one of these last three stages, either the traditional modern rationalism or pluralism. And if we look around the world today, they are literally trying to destroy each other. They simply do not understand each other. They are at war with each other. You know, our attempts to impose a modern democracy onto Iraq. I mean, what a colossal disaster that was. I mean, Iraq was a collection of tribes under a magical heroic, or we would say supervillain, strongman, you know, and to impose modern rational pluralistic values. Similarly, if you look around the world, most of the big conflicts are between groups that whose center of consciousness rests in different stages. And they are literally trying to kill each other. So, at the end of the 20th century, there was another stage that began to emerge, which was somewhat of a radical departure from these early ones. And it's, so they call it second tier, or integral consciousness. Because integral consciousness is able not only to understand, but to enter into and to engage all the lower stage below it. It's to understand how other people think without being patronizing about it. And it recognizes that these stages are actually developmental. So, you know, we got calculus and arithmetic. Well, calculus is more advanced, but a child who understands calculus, we don't think is like inherently more worthwhile than a child who understands arithmetic. So they see them as developmental, and actually see these different stages as appropriate to different situations. So the building catches fire. What are we going to do? Well, we will have a postmodern pluralistic meeting. We'll all gather together in a circle, and we will sing "We Shall Overcome," and then we'll check out in to see how everybody feels about the fire, and then we will brainstorm on different things we might do. Remember, in brainstorming, no criticism, all ideas are equal. We'll put all the ideas up there till we get everybody's ideas up there, and then by consensus, we will decide which we think are most important, and then we'll see if anybody wants to volunteer.
That's too big. Pardon?
That's Japan.
Yeah. If the building catches on fire, we want a magic heroic leader who stands up and says, you get the kids, you call it a fire department, you make sure there's nobody caught in the back rooms, everybody get out of here now. So it's not that these stages are actually more primitive, they're just appropriate to different situations. So this next stage of consciousness, this integral, is called integral because it is whole in its mind and it can integrate all these earlier stages and work with them all at once. And I would suggest that without more integral consciousness, the human species is just going to tear itself to pieces. So this stuff is not just theoretical. So the question becomes, what's next? Have we reached the apex? Have we reached the end of the development of human consciousness? Well, if you look at the history of this, to think it's going to stop with this is just kind of silly. To the contrary, there are likely to be whole new stages that are more inclusive and more complex than integral. And they may be as difficult for us to imagine as it is for somebody with tribal consciousness to imagine pluralism. But it's a safe bet that for our children and grandchildren, there will be more complex, more inclusive ways of processing information and assigning meaning to it, of consciousness. There is a little bit of data to suggest what third-tier consciousness might look like. Not enough people are in that to draw any conclusions, but there are some suggestions. And this is how I think it works. In second-tier integral consciousness, we have the ability to objectively see our own way of thinking. Does it sound like anything any of you ever try to do in meditation, right? You get the ability to begin to see objectively how your mind works and objectively see how other people's minds work and to step back and actually appreciate them, genuinely appreciate them. What seems to happen in third tier is that self-identity itself comes unmoored from any particular way of thinking and extends beyond one body, one personality, one set of ideas, one way of processing information, and expands out to include more than one set of memories. So I began with this image of Thierry de Chardin, because I wanted to give a kind of a feel of what that might look like. If you had this mystical merge with the natural world, he wasn't out there just appreciating. He wasn't out there just enjoying. In some very real ways, he was at one with the world around him. So if that story, if it resonates with you even a little bit, then you have a taste or a glimpse or a hint of what third tier consciousness may look like. For most of us, those experiences are fleeting. And what seems to happen in third tier is it becomes a more or less permanent way of viewing the world. Single organism, single organism spreads out to larger collectives, one awareness looking through many different perspectives. So third tier, the label that the researchers are putting on it is a transcendent, because it transcends the sense of self as innocent beginnings in one organism and goes out to where it begins to include a larger collective. So, Sacramento Insight Meditation. What does all this have to do with meditation? Some people would say not very much. And from a certain perspective, that's true. States of awareness are very different from stages of consciousness. Awareness deepens from normal awareness of the sensory world, sight, sound, smells, taste, to subtle awareness, thoughts, feelings, images, inspirations, to what the Tibetans call very subtle awareness. Begin to see how the mind works right out to pure awareness. You're aware of awareness itself. That's how awareness develops. Consciousness, on the other hand, goes from tribal to heroic to traditional to modern rational to pluralism to integral to transcendent. Very, very different animal. They aren't the same thing. Meditation is mostly about states of awareness. Consciousness is about stages of awareness. Meditation is about waking up. Consciousness is about growing up. You can get the difference of that. Meditation is about cleaning the mirror of awareness so you can see more clearly what's going on. Consciousness is about how we interpret what we see in the mirror. Most of the Buddha's teachings, I am getting back to him. Are you with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So most of the Buddha's teachings are about awareness. So in Buddhist math, I teach a lot about what I call the awareness jhanas. Not this one-pointed business, but how we taught. How awareness, and as you work through the jhanas as the Buddha taught them, you see all these gradations about how you go from this, you know, gross awareness of the sensory realm into subtler and subtler until down to awareness itself and then out beyond that. So the Buddha's teachings about impermanence and suffering, those are all about awareness. Those are things that we can directly see and experience just, you know, in our own being in the world. Anatta, selflessness, is not about awareness. It's about how we interpret awareness. It's about how consciousness, bhavatana, creates a sense of self and projects it onto our experiences. And I suspect that the Buddha, maybe not, but I just imagine him getting really frustrated at times trying to teach him back then, you know, because this urge to project a sense of self is so powerfully wired into us. And that you read through the text, and he's saying over and over again, he says, just stop interpreting your experience. There's no me, there's no mine, there's no myself. Stop the workings of consciousness that way and just directly see what's going on. Easy to say, it's not so easy to do. Any of you know the Jataka Sutta? Majjhima Nikaya number 148. Buddha says, the eye is impermanent. It comes and goes in time. There is no permanent self in the eye. To think the eye is self is just wrong. Bhikkhu Bodhi translated is, to think the eye is self is untenable. But I think he's saying it's just wrong. Light is impermanent. It comes and goes. There is no permanent self there. To think light is self is just wrong. Seeing is impermanent. It comes and goes. There is no permanent self there. To think seeing is self is just wrong. And he drones on and on and on, going through every possible combination of sensation, feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, of liking and disliking and delusion. All those combinations, and he says of all of them, there is no permanent self in any of them. They're just wrong. If you try to read the sutta without all the ellipses, you know, read the full text of it, it takes over an hour to go through the whole thing. It was like he was just trying to pound it into the heads of the monks around him. He says, stop interpreting. Stop creating the sense of self there. Stop constructing sandcastles in the air. To appreciate why the Buddha used this strategy, remember that in his day, the most advanced stage of consciousness that was generally available in the population was traditional mythic literal. Today, it's the consciousness of fundamentalism. It's a consciousness that has a very, very strong sense of self. Us and them, me and you, good guys and bad guys. The Buddha himself, I don't know, it may have been modern rational. I mean, he says over and over again, you have to look in your own experience, you have to work this out for yourself. Those are modern rational values rather than the traditional mythic literal that looks so much to ancient authorities. Maybe the Buddha was pluralist or even integral. We will never know. There's really no way of knowing because we don't have his words. What we have is the words that were remembered and codified and written down by his followers, most of whom were traditional literalists. It's like me going to hear Stephen Hawking's. You know, and then I come back and I tell you what Stephen Hawking was saying. You know, what I could convey to you would be severely constrained by my understanding of modern theoretical physics. So the Buddha's followers, what they could convey about what he said was severely constrained by their traditional literalism. Some probably heroic consciousness in there too. Modern rational ways of thinking did not emerge into the general culture for 2,000 years after the Buddha's death. Despite those enormous obstacles, he seemed to do quite well. There were thousands of people that were up. So, I think our situation today is a little different. In the sanghas that I've been part of, most of them, the center of gravity there of consciousness is postmodern pluralism. Right? We value feelings, looking out for the oppressed, and working in prisons, ecology, green sangha, decision making by consensus, all these other pluralistic values. And the general population, about 20% of people in the industrial world, in the developed world, are pluralistic, and about 5% are integral. And I think in Western sanghas, those percentages are probably a little higher. So we are not that far. We're not that far from third-tier transcendent consciousness. We really aren't. Many of you have had glimpses. You sit in a meditation. For a while it settles down, where the awareness becomes pure, clear, almost luminous. And there's an awareness that feels closer to who you are than anything you've ever thought or felt or experienced, because it is the awareness that notices the thought or feeling experience. It feels very intimate, very kind, very close to the center of what we are, and at the same time, completely impersonal. Does this ring a bell with anybody? You get a taste of that? And you experience in that, and then what happens? It fades.
Right? It's too scary, and you pull back.
Yeah, it can become, because we're so deeply rooted in that, it can become frightening. So one thing you can do with that fear is just see the fear as fear and say, kind of breathe in, relax into it, to not fight it, and kind of open out into it. But the fact that you were able to be there long enough to get scared by it, you wouldn't be scared if it didn't touch a deep chord that really resonated with you. So what I'm suggesting is that there are a lot of us that are closer to that than we may think. And so it's a matter of figuring out how to nudge ourselves in that direction a little bit more. It's not that far away. Does this make sense? How do you do that? So, there's a sense of self. Rather than trying to squish it, get rid of it, to just surrender into it, to just open out into it, and open out into those evolutionary forces that move us towards a transcendent awareness. So you're sitting here, and you let your sense of self expand out through the room, even right now when you're listening to me, sort of include more and more people. You want to try it? You want to do it a little bit? Mm-hmm. See what happens? I know we're getting late. I'm running out of time. Let's spend a little bit of time on this. Okay. Just an experiment. So, sit comfortably. Relax. If there are images and thoughts and feelings that come up, don't worry about them. If you were the 6 R's as I teach, and just 6 R myth, all that means is that when there are images or thoughts come up, you just let them be what they are. You don't fight them, release them, and just relax, soften. And as you soften, I would invite you to just very gently just allow a sense of peacefulness, our well-being, to just gently to radiate out from you, out to the people around you, out into the room. Just a sense of ease, openness, relaxation, well-being. If any fear or contracted states come up, just let them be there. But expand out beyond them. Just let them soften, expand out beyond them. And allow your sense of self to spread out with that peacefulness. So it's as if within this awareness that is you, there are other people, other yogis around you, or inside the awareness that is you. Let your sense of self spread out through the room and beyond. Out beyond the building. It's as if there's one awareness that is looking through your eyes and my eyes and someone else's eyes. One awareness, multiple perspectives. So you let go of the perspective and just be with the awareness itself. Comments? questions, thoughts?
I think that's good. Let go of the perspective and just be aware of the...
Awareness. Awareness, when it doesn't have any contraction in it, doesn't have as much self-identity in it. You just let it spread out. And I was sitting here when we were meditating earlier, and I could feel, you know, I'm up here, I'm on tonight, and I could feel a little bit of that. And I just let a little bit of self-consciousness be there and let the awareness spread beyond it. You don't even have to get rid of it. Just let it be there. Don't get entangled with it. And let the awareness spread out. Yeah. It's just stuff. Kind of cute. Really. Yeah.
There was a wonderful allowing of all the perspectives.
Yeah.
It just felt very loving.
Yeah.
Touch into the loving interconnectedness.
Yeah. And what you're beginning to move into a little bit is a little bit of that pure awareness that's not rooted to one particular perspective. And that pure awareness, part of its inherent nature is it's happy. You know, in a very contented kind of way. It just
hard,
is.
Hard to do.
Yeah.
It's just drive.
Yeah, or to relax into, you know. When you see the place that's contracted hard, you just like soften and spread out into it and then see what happens.
I guess just two things. One, as you're speaking about these different states of consciousness, if I was really honest, my state of mind would go in and out of those all the time. So as you're shaking your head, so that's kind of answering the question of like, is that your experience too? But our state of mind really goes in and out of those.
Yes,
more
for
than we may want to admit.
Absolutely. You know, for purposes of teaching this, as we talk about it as if they're discrete. But somebody who is, let's say, solidly integral, there will be some times when they're really pluralistic, and sometimes, you know, it will spread in different areas of their life. They might be in different places. So it's a matter of getting a sense of them. But I do think that as it begins to move beyond the literal, is that as you become more aware of the field of awareness itself, there is a kind of a unity behind it, which you can slip out of in just a second. You know, you have those sort of deep, peaceful moments, and the next moment it's like, wow, where did that go? You know, it's just...
But there's a beauty in that too, though, because there's actually some... understanding and awareness of it.
That's right.
And there's availability of compassion and allowing that to happen.
Right.
Whereas if you didn't have the awareness that you're going in and out of that, then the separation occurs.
Yeah, and the secret of all of it is actually training the awareness to get the awareness stronger and stronger. So if you're going in and out of it, if you're aware that you're going in and out of it, then the awareness gets stronger. And as awareness gets stronger, it'll take care of the rest of it. You don't even have to do it. All you have to do is nurture the awareness.
There's really nothing happening.
And that's where some of the anatta begins to come in. When the awareness gets so strong that it starts to run on its own a little bit. You know, it's like when you come off retreat and say, okay, I'm tired of being aware. I'm just going to shut it off now. It doesn't shut off. It keeps going, and like, what is keeping that going? Well, it may not be this little peach pit of the self that I think I am. There's something else going on.
Mm-hmm. So I'm playing with this thing, this really interesting distinction you make between awareness and consciousness. But it seems to me that there's a point at which consciousness drops away. When consciousness drops away, it is awareness. Do you know what I mean? Like there's a point where they're not the same.
So the way Ken Wilber and people talk about it, particularly in first year, is that awareness and stage of consciousness are very separate. And I think with integral and particularly transcendent, is that the separation, they're not so different anymore. It's a way of seeing the world that is awareness, but it is a way of seeing and the distinction.
Right, because consciousness is inherently, it's tied to the information processing system.
Well, what happens is as you become aware that you're processing the information, right, then it's hard to take it so solidly anymore. It's like, that's how I'm processing this.
Right, so when there's a release from that system, right, in the consciousness, when there's a release from the information processing system,
then you fall in love with the caterpillars.
So I just want to say, I've been to hundreds of Dharma talks, and this is one of the deepest I've ever experienced. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, and so one thing I wanted to say, parallel with what you were saying, is I bought a book one time on Amazon, among four books. That's what I do, just go find four books and get them. And I put them on my bed and see which one I'm attracted to.
Right.
And then I'll get into it. Well, 2 years later, I got into this book called, this is what it's called, The Most Rapid and Effective Means to Eternal Bliss. That's the name of the book. Mm-hmm. It was written by an enlightened guy who realized that awareness watching awareness to him was the same as the I Am. That 2,000, from reading 2,000 books, the primary author's enlightened beings were pointing to the I Am, but he couldn't get that. He couldn't write that. Awareness watching awareness is exactly what you're talking about right here. And so I begin with, okay, I'm aware of my breathing. There's one awareness. But who is noticing that I'm aware of my breathing?
That's the question.
That is awareness watching awareness.
That's right.
And the mind will fight us until it is exhausted.
Well, so what happens in traditional Buddhism, and I think there's something to this, is that they say that you know, awareness does not arise unless there's an object. You know, so that the awareness and the object arise at the same time. If there's not an object, then what happens is the awareness takes itself as an object. And that's where you get the awareness of awareness. And it's very subtle, and it is quite blissful. And the stuff about awareness has been known for thousands and thousands of years. You know, even go back in some of the oldest part of the Bible, where the first description of God is, you know, I am that I am. You know, it's like, what's it really talking about? So it's the technology of cleansing the mirror of awareness to get to these deep, clear states has been known for a long, long time. What's different today is how we process that information. And so it's like, how do you bring those together?
Very good, thank you. Yeah.
Point of clarification. Mm-hmm. I am that I am is not the proper translation. Modern scholar phrase. I will become what I need to become.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. There are tenses and verbs, you know, and vowels and.
Which is, I think.
Yeah.
More in keeping with what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Isn't it I exist therefore I am by Descartes?
Oh, I think therefore I am was what Descartes said.
I think therefore I am.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I felt like I was softening a lot.
That was just a claim, by the way.
I remember philosophy. I remember a softening of things that were so intense weren't that intense anymore. And I just was in the moment, like you're talking about the thoughts. Mm-hmm. I was thinking and being in the present moment. Mm-hmm. And then I was thinking, all of a sudden it came to me, the visualization, which I read a long time ago, of a Walden Pond. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it was a lake or river, where it was blue and then green, the colors. It looked blue and then it looked green. Mm-hmm. So Henry David Thoreau, was that it?
Yeah, he was one who was at Walden Pond.
Yeah. Yeah, so all of a sudden that image came to me, you know, because I love water and looking at water. And
So that's what's known as subtle awareness. It's noticing the internal images and thoughts and feelings and stuff that you're seeing. Yeah, they happen there. It's getting late. If you like, I have one last thing I could read you from my journal.
Yeah.
For it.
But if you need to get going, go ahead. I'll be deeply insulted, but I'll get over it. I wanted to try to come at this from another angle, just to give another image of it. So, June 2009. I was walking through the woodland along the American River when two snakes reared up out of the grass about 8 feet from me. They were at least 4 feet long. The exposed creamy underbelly gave little hint as to species, but the triangular head suggested venom. They were not within striking distance, so I watched fascinated. After a few moments, I saw the back of one with a diamond pattern and a tail with a rattle. Rattlesnakes are usually shy of humans, so this puzzled me. I wondered if they were fighting each other. But as I watched, their motion seemed more affectionate than combative. They wound around each other, fell back into the grass, rose up again, wound around each other. I smiled softly. They're making love, I thought. They're too distracted to notice I'm here. I'm not particularly scared of snakes, but I never felt so warmly towards two rattlesnakes in a while so close to me. Snakes and humans and all sentient beings feel urges that lead to generating life. I don't know what snakes feel, but I felt a commonality with them. It made me smile. After a while, I moved on. There were lots of butterflies out that day, black ones with white spots. I didn't know their name, but that's fine because they didn't either. I passed one on the ground on the edge of the path. He fluttered his wings without rising into the air, just moved through the dust a few inches. I turned back to take a closer look. His wings were dusty and ragged. Near the end of your life cycle, I whispered to him. I wanted to reach down and touch him to see if he could take flight, but I couldn't imagine a big fleshy finger descending from the sky would be a pleasant experience for a butterfly, so I just observed. His wings moved slowly with his breathing. Butterflies don't live very long, but from their perspective, they live full lives. From their perspective, humans are ancient creatures who live near eternity. One day, I, like the butterfly, will near the end of my cycle. I'm past the middle of mine, probably, and not too near the end, hopefully. I wasn't trying to empathize with a butterfly. How could I know what it feels? But I knew that eventually life ebbs from both of us. In this, we are the same. I walk down the path, leaving the butterfly to die in peace. The urge that starts new life, the ebbing of life. As I gazed at the green woods and meadows around me, I felt touched to be part of it all. My eyes were moist. I think Nietzsche, in a rare soft mood, said, "Suffering is complex, but happiness is simple." Walking through the fields, I felt simple. I felt ordinary. I felt blessed.